Hello and welcome to Behind the Buyouts, the deals podcast where we speak to private equity and venture capital practitioners about their deals and deal making. I'm your guest host, Nikita Satiraju, senior reporter at The Deal. We have with us today John Ferraro, founder and president of investment bank Capstone Partners. He's here to talk to us about the firm's growth since 2002, its strategy for the next several years, and his expectations for M&A in 2025. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you've had a very interesting path from starting in finance to launching Capstone. Tell us a little bit about how you found yourself in the M&A world.
It's a bit of an unorthodox path that I took to get there. I grew up really as an artist and a writer and didn't really know what I wanted to do when I was in college. I was pursuing studies in religion and philosophy. And I think it was 1987, I'm dating myself here, when the movie Wall Street came out. And as an athlete, it seemed fun and fast-paced and completely new and challenging. So I thought I'd give it a try. I landed on Wall Street with Lehman Brothers. And since then, 35 years later, I've been really in mergers and acquisitions, strategic consulting, turnaround management, run the gamut, been a founder of several firms and investor and board members and others. And Capstone has been my most recent venture.
And while you were at Lehman, that's when you found this middle market focus and moved to Rodman and Renshaw, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, I kind of tripped over the middle market as a junior professional. I didn't really know that it existed or what it really meant. And at the time, you know, Lehman Brothers is a bulge bracket firm, one of the leaders on Wall Street at the time. They were doing large transactions, noted for some of the largest leverage buyouts during the late 80s. And there was a smaller client that came in that I think it was a friend of a friend somewhere. And a transaction normally they might not otherwise take on. They took the transaction on and I got staffed in a lead role. It was a husband and wife who owned it. They had started a honey manufacturing company, bee breeding and honey manufacturing. And they had run it for 30 years. And the transaction had a successful closure. And I'll never forget the phone call. This is actually, I'll date myself further. This was pre-cell phone days. I'll never forget the phone call when they closed the transaction. It was a month later. And they had just bought their dream house on the beach. And they called and passed the phone around. And it was like, wow. I could really bridge my desire to try to make an impact on people's lives and in the world with what I enjoyed doing, which was finance and M&A. And that's when the middle market kind of rose itself in my priority list. And I dedicated the rest of my career to having that impact and basically trying to replicate the skill set that Wall Street gives the larger firms, try to bring that down to entrepreneurs and private business owners.
Absolutely. And Capstone was founded at the roots for it took hold at a different firm, and you purchased that practice. And this was Arthur Andersen in 2001.
That was another windy road, I would say. I was with Deloitte's strategy consulting practice in Los Angeles. And my wife and I both grew up in Boston. And I was approached by a headhunter to come and run Andersen's turnaround management group and also start a corporate finance practice, mergers and acquisitions advisory. And it was in Boston. So it was a perfect timing for us. I think she was pregnant with our first child and we were like, great, this is good. This is like a sign from the universe that it's time to go back to Boston. So we landed in Boston, started a practice from nothing for Arthur Andersen, and it became wildly successful. The partners were amazing to us and the practice became the fastest growing, most profitable practice in Andersen's franchise nationally for 5 years in a row. Then that weird world came that was Enron, 9/11, anthrax. Like it was a point in time where we were all waiting for locusts to appear in the sky. And Andersen, unfortunately, met its demise. But during that time period, there was a window where I thought it was time for me to take the entrepreneurial leap. I had started M&A firms for other large companies. We had built it up. I had seen the entrepreneurial role, but it was more corporate entrepreneurship. And I thought that this might be the window for me to take the leap for myself. So Andersen's motivations were to get all their people to high ground at the time. And this was 2000, 2001. So I spun the practice out. I purchased it. I did the typical entrepreneurial leap. I liquidated all my funds, triple mortgaged my house, and bought the practice out of Anderson. So a small, merry group of people started Capstone Partners. We rebranded the company as Capstone, and we were off to the races in year one. And it's made me a better advisor, that journey, the entrepreneurial journey, because when I meet with business owners, I'm having conversations with them from the same seat. I deal with having to make people, processes, technology, strategy decisions every day. So I think it's enriched my perspective as an advisor to my client base. And frankly, the culture that we've built internally at Capstone, I think, brings our firm closer to our client base.
There is one part of your journey that I really loved and we didn't touch on, is going to Australia and playing baseball for two seasons.
Yes, that was also a strange journey. You had mentioned Rodman & Renshaw, which was a middle market firm that I helped start in New York after Lehman Brothers. I was working there for a while and playing in the semi-pro park league, is what they call it in New York, which had, frankly, a host of talent that was much, much better than me. I never made it to any games because I was an investment banker. And then there was one weekend that I actually was able to make the series. Our team went into the playoffs and I showed up. And I hadn't played for 3 years, but I had, for some reason, a ridiculously good performance that weekend. I think it was just a gift from God to say, hey, you're here for the weekend, have fun, and then you're never going to play again. And our team did really well. We ran the gamut, and I was a pitcher, a catcher. I hit well. And at the end of the series, this big, burly, redheaded Australian guy came up to me and said, hell of a series, mate. Would you have any interest in playing professional baseball in Australia? So we're standing around a keg, and I said, grab a beer, let's talk about it. And that Monday morning, I went into the office and there was a fax contract waiting for me. And I signed it and walked into my managing director's office and told him that I resigned. So I moved to Australia for two seasons and played baseball there.
That is just so great. And then you...
wasn't ever that good, by the way. It was a total scam, and I had a lot of fun and held my own for a little while, but I came back. I haven't had to get my life back in order.
That is a great story. And then coming back to Capstone, all your experiences, the middle market focus, the family founder focus at Capstone, all of that informed how Capstone does its business. I'd love to know more about the gamut of services that the firm provides, bringing that large cap experience to middle market.
Yeah, it's been a long road, because when you're a startup, you're focusing on, can I just be relevant in my core offering, which was M&A advisory, primarily sell side advisory. But as we get into middle market transactions, we learned that infrastructures aren't built up quite as much as the larger transactions. The management teams aren't as deep. The technology and the finance function aren't as sophisticated often, not always. And we just found that the business owner needed more. And keep in mind, too, that we spun Capstone out of Anderson. And at Anderson, you're a phone call away from getting an answer to any question, whether it was tax, accounting, wealth management. So we had a platform where we had resources, ported to a platform where we had no resources. So what do you do from there? Our strategy was what I will call an orbit strategy. It was to encircle the private business owner with every capability that they would need, either during a transaction or leading up to a transaction. So what drives business owners? What drives businesses? Not every business owner is looking to sell their company. Sometimes they're looking to get a growth equity partner. Sometimes they're looking just to take some chips off the table to de-risk their wealth concentration. They're pursuing acquisitions. They're raising debt or equity capital. And frankly, sometimes companies go left a little bit. They get off the road or they experience bumps, and they're not performing the way they should, or they might trip a covenant in their loan agreement. So what we built was a firm that could handle everything a business owner needed to handle. So we have all those services: capital raising, debt equity, turnaround management, crisis management, buy side advisory, sell side advisory across 12 different industry verticals.
And it's grown quite a bit in the 20 years from starting the company to the merger with Huntington. You did two growth financings, 9 acquisitions. I was just wondering what those acquisitions brought to Capstone, what the thinking behind those deals were.
You're spot on. We did two rounds of growth financing and 9 acquisitions exactly. That resulted in over a 20-year period, we had a compounded annual growth rate that exceeded 25%, which is an extraordinary run. But the beauty of history is that you actually get to control your narrative. It wasn't that pretty. It was not up and away every year. The markets have something to say about that. So I think during that 20-year period, we had at least 4, maybe 5 pretty major market corrections. So the key to it is always build. It's just like any business owner. You have to always move forward. And what you learn as a business owner in the M&A markets or in the investment banking market, it's actually a good time when the markets pull back a little bit. Because when the markets are on a run, you're just taking tickets. Your head's down and you're grinding through transactions. Make hay while the sun's out is the saying. But when the market pulls back, it allows you to breathe and it allows you to focus on organizational development. And you refine your strategy, you refine your incentives and your organization and your people and refresh your culture and your commitment to the community and all those things that make up a great firm that you don't have time to really focus on when the market goes for a run. So we took advantage of that. And if you go back in history and look at the market downturns and our performance, we invested most heavily in the market downturns. And most of the acquisitions that we did were in market downturns. So we focused specifically, our acquisition strategy really has not wavered over the course of the past 25 years. We're looking to add good people first and foremost. We're looking to bolster our culture. If something's not culturally aligned with your firm, it's a waste of time, whether it's an acquisition, a tuck-in, an acqui-hire, whatever. If it threatens your culture, then it's not going to be good for your business. Add new capabilities and expand geographically. And new capabilities, I mean, maybe a new offering. Like last year, we added ESOP advisory. This year, we added outsourced corporate development for private equity firms on the buy side. So if you can get all of that together, then we move forward. I would say we've done 9 acquisitions. I've probably looked at close to 100. So we're highly selective in what we seek to do.
That's incredible. And the merger with Huntington too, it wasn't something that you were really planning to do, but it happened. I'd love to know how that whole thing came about.
You're going to find a common theme here is that I trip through life and hope that some of it works out. That was another one that I didn't really see coming. So to be truthful, we hit a point in time at Capstone where there was a mismatch between what we were capable of, given what we've built, and what the balance sheet was able to support. Not dissimilar to a lot of our clients, where they might need private equity. And by the way, it took me 20 years to get halfway to where I wanted to be. And I don't know if I've got enough gas in the tank to do another 20 years in the seat. So what I wanted to do was go to market and find a private equity partner to really accelerate our growth. And that was going to be primarily driven by additional acquisitions or hunting for bigger game, as I call it. And so instead of, I think the largest transaction that we had done was just below $20 million. We wanted to be able to reach bigger and go for larger transactions that could move the needle more significantly in specific swipes. So we were preparing to go to market. We actually hired an investment bank. I can't preach the value of hiring an investment bank to my clients and not take that on myself. And to be true, like half the battle in hiring an investment bank is you've got to be able to focus on your own company and your own growth. And I have client responsibilities. I don't have time to go to market, frankly, to run our own process. So we were getting ready to go to the private equity market. And the banker had introduced me to Huntington Bank, because they're a growth-oriented, culture, purpose-driven, regional commercial bank that didn't have an investment banking capability. And I think they have 15,000 corporate clients that use investment banking services and need them. So they've been in the market and thinking about an acquisition strategy to get into investment banking. So I took a lunch meeting, and to be truthful, I tested them out a little bit on the culture thing. I took him into one of my favorite restaurants in the North End here in Boston, and it is old school brick wall. It's not bougie. It had like torn seats, but the food is spectacular. So I figured if they weren't really comfortable in this place that I've been going to since I was a kid, that it probably would show itself. But it turned out that their strategy was super impressive. Their aggressiveness in their growth initiatives actually surprised me. And the weight they were putting on the importance of investment banking in their total client solution was really attractive to me. And of course, they brought a balance sheet, which could accelerate our ability to do acquisitions. And one thing that I underestimated, because we wanted to double the company in a short period of time, 5 years, they've got an infrastructure in risk management, compliance, cybersecurity, all the stuff that we would need to build to double the company. They had it all in place. So it was kind of like that old commercial where somebody walks down the street with a jar of peanut butter and someone's carrying a bar of chocolates that bump up and Reese's is born. It just seemed like a fit that felt good to both sides, and we pursued it. And frankly, we got that transaction done. I think we met in February, signed an LOI 2 or 3 weeks later, and closed the deal in March and waited for regulatory approval, which came in June. And then we were off to the races.
That was really quick. And how has the mergers helped you over the past couple of years? I'd love to know more about what you're thinking about for the next 3 to 5 years, but 22 to 24, what was that period like post-acquisition?
To be completely transparent, and again, this is another comment I'll share with you that brings me closer to our clients. Going through your own M&A transaction is completely different than advising anyone. Understanding the emotional roller coaster that you go through and what life is like after the transaction and adopting to actually having a boss or having to have feedback to your decision. And frankly, I thought that would be interesting because I think at the CEO level or founder level, often you lack peers. It's a heavy position. It's often a lonely position. So I was actually looking forward to learning something in this process, to growing as a professional and having peers. So I was welcoming of that. But I would be lying if I said it was not an adjustment post-transaction adapting to the regulated bank environment. I knew there was an infrastructure, but the level of focus on compliance, legal, cybersecurity, you don't know what you don't know until you get into it, or be careful what you ask for. We needed that, and we got it, and we got it in hyperspeed. So the first year was intensely focused on taking our entrepreneurial Wild West run and gun kind of solution and organizational framework and porting that and re-engineering it so that could operate effectively in the Huntington Bank environment. So we needed to put that work in to set the foundation to then be able to double the company. And the process we've also been wildly successful in matching our solutions with theirs and the delivery of those solutions to the client base. Their clients have been spectacular. Their brand is extremely strong. Their approach to solution is dead on with the way we approach the market. So it's really been, even though we've maintained our own brand in the marketplace, we really operate as one brand, one face to the market. And we are often in meetings together, helping each other out and co-pitching. And it's been pretty seamless on that front. So I'm bullish. It's been kind of 2 full years in the integration mode. And all that heavy work is lifting now. So we're completely market focused. And as I talked about the market focus and taking advantage of building while the markets are down, keep in mind that if you annualize volume year to date through the end of the year in M&A, which isn't completely fair because Q4 is usually busier. But if you were to do that, I think that results in the middle market doing somewhere around 11,000 transactions. That's almost 40% below where we were in 2021. Now, granted, that was a record because it sucked up a lot of the COVID demand, but still 40% is not a small number. So my point is we've been in a protracted down market for quite some time. So it gave us an opportunity to really focus on this organizational alignment. And we wanted to get it all done before the market started to run. And I do think that's where we're heading.
Absolutely. So the next few years, I'm curious to know what capabilities, geography, anything that you're looking at to double the business in size.
Ooh, there are a lot of components to that. Doubling's a heavy lift, especially when we're coming out of building infrastructure to be able to do it. So we're not starting entirely from zero. We added capabilities. I had mentioned our ESOP capability, and we bolstered up our equity capital raise capability and then added this outsourced corporate development capability. But if I could step back from the tactical things we did to add capabilities, just bring it up a level from a strategic thinking perspective. We are keen on trying to leverage what we do best as a firm to drive our future strategy. Strategy 101, find what you do well and find areas to replicate it. So as we considered what really drove our growth over the course of the last 20 years, yes, acquisition was part of it, but every year we were doing something significant for the firm. And we have over the last 2 years as well. But looking forward, that's not enough to move the needle. That's not enough to double the firm. We have to get back into acquisition mode. But getting back to what else we've done well is our strategy was driven entirely around building orbits, as I mentioned early, solution orbits around the private business owner. And we thought that was a key differentiator for us. We did so probably because I was not smart enough to recognize it during the time. We did it at the sacrifice of the private equity community. We were not focused enough on how do we serve the private equity community in a compelling, differentiated manner, the same way we did the private business entrepreneur market. So we're taking our orbit strategy approach and we're applying it to the private equity community. And when you think about that, it's what else can you do for your private equity partner? And I've used that word specifically, private equity partner. Because when you're only offering people deal flow, like we have 100 sell side M&A transactions at any given point in time, that's value. But you're just still a vendor. What we're trying to do is get to more the partner seat, where we're in it with the life cycle of a private equity firm. So the orbits that we build, they include acquisition financing, debt advisory for the acquisitions they're doing. It's performance improvement. It's quality of earnings. It's buy side due diligence. Now outsource corporate development for their portfolio companies looking to do bolt-on acquisitions. And eventually we'll continue to add rungs in this orbit all the way to, at some point, we're interested in being able to raise funds for private equity firms as well. So we want to be the complete shop to private equity, including the product side of the world. So those solutions are what we're looking to deliver on the Capstone side. But in this merger with Huntington, we're able to bring a completely different set of capabilities, balance sheet capabilities, banking with a balance sheet, which we could never do. We just couldn't dream of doing that before. And some of the things we can bring to the table are actually providing the acquisition financing, not just for portfolio company platform acquisitions, but for bolt-on acquisitions. There's capital call line of credits, facilities that we can bring now, treasury management facilities that we can provide portfolios. So we can come to a private equity firm and offer them soup to nuts, beginning to end, advisory solutions, but we can also be their banking partner. And that's something that we think is going to be compelling. We have almost all the pieces in place right now and are getting ready to launch strategic positioning in the marketplace and really market to people so they're aware of what we have and how we can operate as long-term partners to their funds.
And this would be still middle market private equity fund?
Still middle market. And there are larger players than us in the marketplace, our competitors, that are deeply entrenched in private equity. So this is a tough go for us. It's going to have to be guerrilla warfare, really. This is going to be built up one client at a time.
And you also mentioned you're kind of in this stage of liftoff. I'm curious to know what your expectations are for 2025 M&A. Do you think it will be better than 24? We still have a little time to unpack everything that's happened over the past few years.
Yes. Well, so what I'm very positive about right now is that the election's behind us. Mm-hmm. I mentioned this prolonged cycle that we've been in. And during that cycle, I think what the market has lacked, or certainly our industry, speaking more narrowly, we've lacked visibility. And it's been frustrating to watch. And I'm not blaming the Fed. I think the Fed has operated spectacularly through this cycle of sensitivity and volatility. So there's been this feeling that the U.S. economy is ready to run. It's like it doesn't need to be babies. So I think to some degree, the Fed has been treating the U.S. economy as a newborn when we're up and going and ready to roll. So the lack of visibility has provided a beta, a level of risk to people. Without answers, you can't engage in guesswork. So I think the first domino to fall is this election. And frankly, I will tell you, irrespective of what's happened in the market over the last couple of days, I think regardless of who won the election, at least there was certainty that we were going to be moving forward. Now, the markets reacted very favorably to Trump, as everybody knows. But more so than that, the Fed's come in immediately with another Fed cut, a rate cut. That's spectacular, because then let's deal with the trickle-down effects of what happens in the M&A market. CEO confidence goes up. They're supporting lower rates. Not only are they supporting lower rates, they've signaled that there's much more to come. So if we start to normalize in a interest rate environment that's in the mid to high twos, see, we just did a piece on this recently that I believe we published. We track CEO confidence levels to the Fed rate and what's the impact of it. And then we overlaid on top of that was M&A volume. And we found that CEO confidence virtually explodes when the Fed rate's low, because they've got a lot of opportunity in the business environment and they feel good about where the economy is going. But M&A growth is 1.5 times greater in periods where the Fed rate's in the twos. So I think we see a path to get there. That's really what's happening externally. But if we look at the fundamentals, there really are three things that are going on, some of which I've touched upon, that we're long overdue for a run in M&A. And number one is, I'll just point very simply to biology. As much as we all try, people just don't grow younger. So the private business owner that has postponed this for 4 or 5 years, waiting for the markets to get better, the M&A environment to be more favorable, is now older, and their goals are more pressing, and their need to diversify and take care of their families is probably a little more heightened. So we've got that dynamic. The second point I would note is capitalism. So capital generally does not ever grow more patient.
Yes.
So in this time period, we've seen a lot less platform acquisitions for private equity. We have seen deal volumes go down. We have seen exits go down of their portfolio companies. So the lifespan of their existing portfolio companies have extended. They need to show return, of course. It's fundamentally raise money, get return, do your next fund. So there's this pent-up demand. And the last thing I would point to is just history. Over my career, at least, which is now 35 years, is that down cycles tend to last 12 to 18 months. 24 months is a long down cycle. In December, we'll be in 36 months of a down cycle.
Oh, wow.
And over time, you've also found that because of technology and information and market efficiency, cycles tend to compress. Both up cycles and down cycles are shorter. The market corrects and things kind of work themselves out faster. So this is abnormal. In the post-COVID world, we had that boom in 21 that set new records. But since that year, it's been a down cycle. So the protracted down cycle is ready to end. So biology, capitalism, and history are all in our favor. And then you put the certainty that has happened with this election. I would say you're going to start to see significant volume increases in the M&A markets as early as Q1 of next year.
That's fantastic. And because Capstone covers such a wide range of sectors, are there any particular industries where you're seeing more buyer and seller interest, or do you think it's kind of a mixed bag when it comes to that?
Well, that's a good question. And it's so specific to sectors. So I'm going to paint kind of a broad picture, because some sectors were crushed in the down cycle. Some sectors were pretty resilient. And then we have some that were hit pretty hard that have come back pretty well. So let me start with those. I'll call them the comebackers. So I would put three major industry sectors in the comebacker categories. Those that got hit early, valuations and volumes retreated but we've seen since that, that they've come back pretty strong. And I would note healthcare, business services, and building products. Those industries for us have been the strongest comebackers. So in healthcare, for example, I think multiples were off like 25, 27% since the highs of 2021. Those have come back and almost back to where they were. Business services, it was not as dramatic as a decrease as that, but we've also seen areas of that marketplace that have come back, the professional service market specifically. For example, if you look at what's going on in the accounting industry, people were never paying any attention to the accounting industry. Now we're seeing double-digit multiples going off in accounting with very strong private equity interest in building products as well. And frankly, there's been a run in roofing, even within building products, that has helped fuel that quite a bit. Moving on to those sectors that have been very resilient for us, and I think this is true to the broader economy, it's been aerospace and defense, mainly driven by government contracts. It's, again, lower beta, more visibility, more consistency. It's not a surprise that that's been fairly resilient. Consumer has been very consistent for us. Some of the branded products have really carried the day for us, not so much long-term fixed capital consumer products, but more of the branded consumer products, and then energy. And I don't mean oil and drilling and mining and things like that. I mean more the transition economy, more focus on companies and emerging enterprises that are coming up with innovative solutions for the transition economy. And then there are the ones that get crushed in value that we're starting to see green shoots. And I would put kind of almost the whole tech sector in that. It's bounced back well. But in our areas of focus, I would point to our software practice is bouncing back. Our fintech practice has done well. Our industrial tech practice has done well. And frankly, for that, even outside of tech, after the supply chain logistics issues kind of eased back, our transportation and logistics practices is doing very well. So we're seeing green shoots everywhere.
That's incredible. What have I not asked you, either about M&A in general, middle market M&A in general, or Capstone, that you think is a highlight that we should touch on?
Wow, that's a good question.
It's a broad question. I know.
I think the question is going to be outside of Capstone, where's the market going in M&A for M&A? And are we going to see consolidation in this space? And I think the answer is yes. We are already hearing rumors of spinouts and people getting rid of practices, or people looking at larger firms, looking at some components of investment banking as non-core, which will certainly present opportunities for acquisitive firms like ours. I do think you're going to see the commercial banking industry get back into the M&A game for investment banking, because they're coming out of a period of high regulation and scrutiny in the post-SVP era. It was lockdown. It was, don't do acquisitions, make sure you get your house in order. I think that's passed, and I think we're going to see the world focusing more on investment banking M&A. And I also think we're going to see some innovation in M&A. I think investment banks are thinking about being more holistic in their offerings, and we've already started to see that. I mentioned earlier about really partnering with private equity with the ability to be able to raise funds. So even fund one.
Yeah.
But fund two, fund three, fund four. How do you build a killer app in investment banking? How do you diversify from the ups and downs of M&A? You just encircle people with the solutions they need. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that coming down the pipe in the next 3 to 4 years.
Absolutely. Well, John, thank you so much for a fantastic conversation. Really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you so much. I've had a lot of fun. Thanks for being such a warm host.
Thank you. This is Nikita Satyaraju, senior reporter at The Deal. Thanks for tuning in to Behind the Buyouts.